It's the Truepenny Show with your host, James Truepenny.
Hello and welcome to the Truepenny Show. My name is James Truepenny and this is my show. Today, I'm on my own. After a confluence of events, which has meant that both the staff of the Truepenny Show and Freelance Wrestling Rewind have ended up busy this weekend and we didn't have a show to present to you. Now, normally this doesn't happen because we always have one in the bag, but for now, we don't. We will rectify that situation in short order as soon as we possibly can. But for this week, I'm on my own, which really I don't like, I'll be honest. I don't like listening to solo shows myself, and I don't like doing solo shows myself because I have a tendency to waffle like I am now, and I'd much rather go with someone to have a conversation with, because that's kind of the point of the Truepenny Show, really. You want a conversation, it's me plus other people, Chelsea, Alex, Marcus, Cy, Alex, Christy, the other people that help make the show what it is. And I'm really appreciating them right now because they're not here, unfortunately. However, we have come up with a plan B. Last night on Twitter, I asked for a bunch of questions to be asked so that we could talk about things you want to hear about and ask us for opinions on things that have been going on in the wrestling industry. Now, I did this 2 years ago, and it's a show of sign of strength to how well show. It's a sign of strength to how well the show is received these days that we got loads of responses. Because when I tried 2 years ago, nothing. I think I got about 4 or 5 questions, and they were all friends, and I had to solicit the questions from them. So really, we're doing really, really well. And it's been a year since we've been off of Wrestle Talk, and actually, we're on a much smaller platform that we're organizing ourselves, and we seem to be getting a lot more invested responses, shall we say. There's a lot more people who are talking to us about the things we say on the show. We used to get a lot more listeners when we were on part of the WrestleTalk Network, and those guys are cool, and we still love them to bits, and Ollie and Luke do a great job on their show. But we have more people who are willing to interact with us, which is really, really cool, and we're really happy about. Anywho, so we'll ask these people some questions. I'll ask questions of these people. Now, if I just go to my Twitter feed here, I can get questions. First of all, from the Smarky Betch. That's from the Marin Marks podcast. That's Lady Mark. She asks us, if there was a shakeup in New Japan wrestling factions, who would you move and why? I quite like them as they are, to be honest with you. I think possibly Taiji, from a traditionalist point of view, I'd want to move Taiji Ishimori out of Bullet Club. I don't think he fits there. I think he fits because Tama Tonga loves him in a way that I'm not completely comfortable with, because Tama's married, as we discussed, me and Christy discussed last week. I think I like the idea of Gaijin's being in Bullet Club and just having one Japanese guy who denies the fact he's actually Japanese. I think that's really, really cool. I'd put Ishimori into Chaos. That would fit better, I think. But they had Will Ospreay, so they had already had one junior ace. They didn't need another one. Who else would I move around? LIJ is perfect. It's a perfect balance. Chaos, I'd ship Ospreay off somewhere else, happily. Yeah, swap Ospreay for Ishimori, and I'd be quite happy, I think. Not the biggest fan of William, as you've probably guessed if you've listened to the show. I mean, I think he's a great wrestler. I think he's an absolutely fantastic talent. It's just the fact that he runs his mouth so often and so stupidly, we can't keep forgiving him for growing up because he's a grown-up now. You know, he's about to get married. He should know this stuff. So, yeah, I would, purely from a fan point of view, I'd want Will out of Chaos and stick him in Bullet Club and be well happy. Suzuki Gun's just about perfect. Be interesting to see if they're going to get rid of Iizuka. Well, what they're going to do once they've got rid of Iizuka. He's retiring in February, so I don't know. But that's really all I'd move around. I don't want the other thing. We'll save that. We'll ask them that as well next time we do a Q&A. We're going to do more Q&As, by the way. It's just this one I had to do by myself, but Christy suggested it a few weeks ago, so I thought we'd use it for an idea to see how well this one goes. And you can tell us, do you think it's working, or do you think we should do one with more people? Right, next comes from one of our regular listeners, Boxcar Rockford, on your Twitter there. He always asks us questions about the show and various other things in wrestling. Besides New Japan and Stardom, what are some of the other Japanese companies that have really cool stuff going on right now? Well, you've heard me and Christy talking about DDT and TJPW, Tokyo Joshi Pro Wrestling. They're doing really, really cool stuff. I would suggest you go look at their streaming services. They're pretty easily available, easily available to Western watchers. Space Monkey signed for DDT. He's on their next tour. A lot of American indie guys go over there. Ethan Page, his first Japanese tour was with DDT. Colt Cabana was signed to DDT until recently. Well, not signed because he doesn't do signs. He always like does a handshake deal. He's moved to New Japan for this next tour because they're coming to the US and he's touring with them as part of Ring of Honor. But yeah, DDT and TJPW, a very different take on professional wrestling in Japan. But you should enjoy those two companies. Sendai Girls, which is my favorite Japanese wrestling company. I watch more New Japan, but Sendai Girls is my favorite company. Are doing incredible things. Got a big feud going on with Stardom at the moment. We could get to lining up against Chira Hoshimoto, the two champions of the two respective companies. Really working well as well. They had a barnstorming tag match, Hizuki and Kigetsu versus Chihiro Hashimoto and Dash Chikuso at Kirikan Hall in October. That was absolutely phenomenal. You should really watch that. And if you want to get a bigger opinion on what the others think, me, Christy, and Chelsea, we covered a Sendai Girls show from around that time early last year. So you can go back in the archive and find it there. Noah are kind of spinning their wheels at the minute and not getting too far. Same pretty much with All Japan, though. They're steadily growing. They're showing steady growth, and they have a streaming service where you can catch loads of different things on. So that's well worth looking into if you want to try and find some more stuff that's Japanese wrestling-based. Other stuff, there's loads of things. You go to ProWrestleDream.com, I think it's .com, or just search ProWrestleDream, P-R-E-S-U Dream on Google, and you go to the website there. You find a lot of the shows that are indie shows, which you can find for free on ProWrestleDream, or the TV shows that have been there. You can find them, watch the whole shows. There's usually a listing, and people comment on those videos as well, so you can find out a lot more information. There's companies like 666 that do small indie shows at Shinkawa First Ring. I should really explain that. Like, most of the big companies treat Kurikan Hall as their TV taping place. So, like, New Japan will do new beginning shows at the minute. So they're doing the Road 2 shows, and they'll do one at Kurikan Hall. Occasionally you'll get a big event there, like Best of Super Juniors final. But to a lot of the smaller companies, Kurikan Hall is the holy grail. If you can fill Kurikan Hall, you're doing really, really well. So Sendai Girls treat that as their kind of like their front yard as far as the Josh is concerned. Stardom use that place all the time for their big shows. So companies like 666 are going to places like Shinkawa First Ring. Shinkawa First Ring is one of the last stops on the bullet train as you go out of Tokyo towards Kawasaki, I think. And you can go down to this small little theater that's specifically designed for wrestling and nothing else. You know, they've laid out a lighting rig and a seating arrangement for about 110 people. Stardom used to have their dojo in there, you know, and I know cheerleader Melissa actually has crashed nights in there when she used to stay in Japan for when she was working Joshi. So it's very much a Joshi environment and very much a small independent wrestling environment. You can run a small show in there. It doesn't cost too much money. They run wrestling 7 nights of the week with different companies. And it's one of the places that was busiest during K-Hole week, during Wrestle Kingdom week. So yeah, you should check out the smaller companies. They're doing all sorts of different and interesting things. Sometimes it's just straight up regular wrestling. Sometimes it's hardcore. Sometimes it's just doing stuff that's different. BJW are doing cool stuff at the moment. They're kind of splitting their roster up to deathmatch and strong style. And it's been very interesting to see that develop. But yeah, all sorts of cool stuff going on in Japanese wrestling generally, because when one company's hot, they're all hot, like the way it is at the moment. When New Japan's getting hot, everyone else is getting hot too. And it's starting to move some creative juices. As far as the Joshis is concerned, Tokyo Joshi Pro are doing good stuff. Oz Academy are getting big crowds at the minute. You should try and look at their stuff. You can usually find some of their stuff on YouTube as well. But yeah, all of them. Really, don't disregard any of them. You should go and have a look, see what you find, because it's loads of companies. I guarantee you will find a Japanese wrestling company to your tastes. You will like something that you see. Next comes from Wilfred Watches Podcast, part of the Social Suplex Network. Wilfred is a follower of us, but he's also a podcaster himself. And he asked, should Twitter hold more authority when combating hate online, or does society need to bear the weight of the responsibility? Now, when he asked this question, I was like, well, yeah, he was kind of like thinking like wrestling questions. And then his reply was, I think it goes hand in hand with wrestling. Bandwagon hate, stan accounts, mental health of wrestlers, reading the hate, just on my mind since the latest episode on the subject. Curious to hear your opinions. So, Wilfred, we shall answer your question. It's a big question, really, and it's difficult to break down into a wrestling context. I think it also doesn't reflect necessarily well on, well, it doesn't reflect well on society. You know, there have been trolls around forever on the internet, and I had troll issues back in the early 90s when I first started, well, mid-90s, when I first started using the internet on a regular basis. There was always guys who were willing to have a fight, and trolls will always be there, I guess, because there's always people who want to gain attention for themselves in any way, and that's really down to their mental health issues and their self-esteem. Yes, it does play into the wider issue, and my personal point of view is it tends to hit the people who are just beginning or in the middle of their careers, because you think about somebody like Becky Lynch or The Rock or Steve Austin or any of the big stars of today, they get hundreds of thousands of negative tweets thrown at them every day, but it just washes over and they tend to ignore it. Whereas people who are at the beginning or in the middle of their careers tend to get ridiculous tweets sent to them all the time, and female performers get horrible tweets sent to them all the time. And I think that tide is starting to turn, but equally, there is an attitude that people in the public eye are defenseless. They don't deserve any respect from people, which is kind of the opposite of the way we used to think about people in the public eye. And I think it's very horrible, really, for people who are trying to just make a living. It's just that they make a living as something they enjoy that puts themselves in front of a wider audience. And I never forget, as a wrestling fan, that these people are sacrificing their bodies for my entertainment, which is something I think we forget. Now, is it down to society? Is it down to Twitter? Off the top of my head, I think it's partly down to society, but to change a society takes an awful long time. You know, and to change Twitter takes some coding. That's really all it does. So, you know, you can, for instance, say, well, Twitter are going to lose money if they lose too many people. That's true. But they should also be taking on the responsibility to make their social area, their social space, a safe place to be, because that will attract more people anyway. Social media companies do have an awfully big role to play in this, because you know, this doesn't happen in real life. You do get people who are just horrible to you in real life, but tend not to just stand and insult you in the street, because that's a brave thing to do. That requires an awful lot of thought process and a lack of fear, which bullies online don't tend to have. They tend to be fearful. So I think it's an interesting question to raise. As far as wrestling fans are concerned, I think the majority of them behave themselves quite well. I think people who don't agree with me or my opinions can have a reasonable debate. You've seen me and Chris Cruz go at it several times. I'm trying a new tack of being nice to Chris and killing him with kindness this year, and it seems to be working. He's retweeted me and smiled at me a couple of times now. But me and Chris kind of like don't like each other's opinions, and we talk to each other about it, and we try and work these things through. He's often dismissive, and sometimes he's not. He will actually engage in what we're trying to say, and that's the kind of thing that we want from people on Twitter, even when when they don't agree with us. We want to have engaging conversations so we can all get better, because that's kind of what the internet was about. We don't really have engaging conversations anymore, and I'm as bad as it for anyone. What I was sadly disappointed earlier this year was, well, right at the beginning of this year, one of our listeners, who was fairly right-wing-leaning, just left us and was very vocal on Twitter about, I'm going to have to leave you now because I retweeted something that was pretty funny and left-wing. And I was like, he's been listening to us for 3 or 4 months and interacting with us, and it's like, have you not followed me on social media? I'm pretty left-wing. I'm pretty open about that. You know, I talk in that way, and not all of us on the Troopany Show are left-wing, but most of us are centrist to left-wing. And we are all fairly active in our political commentary. But apparently this guy hadn't caught up on the fact that we were left wing. So he told us that he would, if we'd produced merch, he would burn his merch and that he won't be listening to us anymore. And I'm like, well, what can we do? We're not going to change our entire opinions just because we've lost one listener. That doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. It doesn't make any sense for us to change the way we are because we've built an audience that are kind of used to us being the way we are. So, yeah, I like the idea of people engaging with us. If they don't agree with us, at least come and talk to us. You may not agree with everything we say. If it's facts-based, we tend to be as factually accurate as we can. If we get corrected, we don't mind. We try and be corrected. But generally speaking, I think the thing is, it's partly on Twitter and Facebook and other social media organizations to organize themselves and have better ways of reporting and better ways of ending hate online. But I think it's also partly down to society to regulate itself more and just be polite, engage with people, you know, be a fan without being creepy. Be a fan without, like, being over the top. I mean, I have friends who have Stan accounts who are kind of comedically over the top, but they're not, like, you know, ridiculously horrible. And sometimes they just make me laugh with the things they're trying to say as jokes. But sometimes it is hurtful, and people do get hurt. So, yes, six of one, half a dozen of the other is my thought process. I think we could all be a lot nicer to each other, but equally we need safe places to play too. Okay, next question goes to Whitney Nicole. That's Lying Delilah on Twitter, who has been a long-time follower and a long-time listener, and we always appreciate her commentary. She asks if you could book if you could book one intercompany show, that what would your three headliner matches be? If I could book one intercompany show, I would book Sendai Girls versus New Japan Pro Wrestling, and my headline would be Meiko Satomura versus Kazuchika Okada, Hiroshi Hashimoto versus Tomohiro Ishii, and Dash Chisako versus Tetsuya Naito. That would be my top three, because if we're into fantasy land booking, I'm going to pick girls versus boys all the time. Intergender is kind of my deal, but I think those would be the three matches that would be unreal to watch. Kazuchika Okada versus Meiko Satomura, how Meiko was going to deal with that height, how Okada would deal with that excellence and that speed. Yeah, and Hashimoto versus Ishii, two powerhouses going at each other. Essentially, Chihiro Hashimoto wrestles like Bruno Sammartino, which is female, and I think Ishii would have something to play with there. I think that'd be really interesting. And then Dash Chisako versus Tetsuya Naito, absolute hyper-speed pro wrestling versus Tranquilio. Opposites attract. That's where I'd put those two. I think that'd be excellent. We're just Dash trying to jump off of Ryogoku's balcony and getting banned. That'd be my kind of deal. So something very, very different. If you're talking like WWE versus New Japan, I kind of don't know, because I don't watch WWE enough to have like any kind of say on it, but that'd be my answer. It'd be Sendai Girls versus New Japan. I'm sure the others would have different answers. We can ask them at some point in the future. Also, who has the worst hair? Ooh, well, I mean, again, normally we do this as a group opinion, so I'm going to have to go with this worst hair myself, which, when you've seen my hair, which is dreadful, I can't really comment. So I'm going to say, I'm going to offend some people here if I say what I think. Worst hair, Naito. Look at that thatch on top of his head. He's not really trying. It's not a mullet. It's not halfway near to anything. Whereas the rest of them, like, need to square him up. Like, rest of LIG need to get him, LIJ need to get him sorted out with a decent haircut. That's my personal preference. It's neither one thing nor the other. He needs to get better at it. an historic honorable mention too. Worst hair in wrestling history. Les Kellett has pretty terrible hair. It was all over the place, but it kind of suited his comedy act. Mick McManus, who would have turned 99 years old this week, had, I've no idea what was going on in his head, but his hair never looked any different from day to day or week to week. It was always the same. So Mick McManus had pretty terrible hair. Overall, Hogan's Ring of Fire baldness wasn't particularly great. Antonio Inoki, what happened with his hair? It always seemed to be fixed as well. I suppose it depends on how you see. We see the mullet as ironically great, but it is a dreadful haircut. So you have to say the entire FMW roster of the mid-1990s collectively have the worst hair in pro wrestling history. They all looked dreadful. From Atsushi and Ichi on down. It's like they caught a mullet bug and they all had to have the same haircut. Or maybe it was just because Megumi Kudo was in the same roster and she just outshone everybody. You had the greatest hair in pro wrestling history and then everyone else was just going to be running alongside, weren't they? Lisa Lovecraft, another long-time listener, she asks, what worries you about AEW? Interesting question. I do like this question a lot. All Elite Wrestling, what worries me about them? I've talked this week with Patrick Reed, who works a lot with Pro Wrestling Eve, and I've talked a lot with, obviously, Chelsea from Shoulders Up. And their two biggest concerns, and I'll repeat their concerns, which I'm not quite as concerned about as they are, but I completely understand why they are, is their representation of women as being equally paid is hard to prove. Because how do you suggest that certain people have drawn so much money? I don't know. There is the female-male issue to start with, but I'm also slightly concerned about how they're going to quantify success. Because if you look at the big wrestling companies in history that have been successful, WCW used to play a flat fee. You got paid like $150,000. You wrestled so many dates. If you went up the card, you renegotiated your contract. And it could be a long time. So you could be headlining for 2 years and only be earning $150,000. Whereas somebody else who started at the top and fell down fairly quickly could still be on $400,000. So it was a tricky place to work and it was a tricky place to navigate the paychecks. WWE has only ever been giving an opportunity. It was only until the middle of the Monday Night Wars that they started off with a downside guarantee. Which is probably the best way of paying people in one sense. When you have competition, you're going to be guaranteed a certain amount of money so you can pay the mortgage. After that, it's performance related. And the harder you try, the more successful you are, the more money you'll get paid. That's reasonable. Okay, that's going to make good house money. And you're also going to have the added bonus of your staff not being worried that they're not going to be able to pay the mortgage. In Japan, traditionally, they've worked on one big money signing fee and then a bonus for going up the card and a bonus for hard work and effort. So that's probably going to be, you know, that's another model that works really well. It's kind of similar to the WWE model. Certainly in the back in the day with guys like Joe and Baba were booking, the bonuses became really important. I used to get a signing on bonus. You get a start of the year. You get a small contract bonus, then you get a larger, you get paid per night, and then you get a bonus at the end of the year. So, and you'd also get night-to-night bonuses as well. So, it's difficult way they're going to structure the pay, because if everyone's an equal pay, men, women, everybody bottom of the card, top anybody card, you're not going to keep guys like Jericho around, because they're there to make big bucks, they're big signings. So I think it's really interesting on how they're going to evolve this. I think it's going to be interesting to see if they can sustain it, because they're going to have an awful lot of people sitting around for a while on big money contracts. So that's the one thing that majorly worries me about overall about the promotion. Secondary to that is, are the women going to get paid equally? They've only signed one or two women. It would have looked an awful lot better if they'd signed five or six women like they signed five or six guys and show it's not an afterthought. If they're working with Japanese companies, Stardom is the obvious one to me. Brandi Rhodes has worked for Stardom before, and Rossi Ogawa will work with anyone, so, and sometimes to his detriment. So I would suggest that Stardom is possibly the people to go to, and we'll see what happens there about the women that they're going to bring in from Japan. But then again, Stardom already had a deal with Ring of Honor, because Sumi Sakai organized that a couple of years ago. So we'll see what happens there as far as North America is concerned. Those are my two major concerns. I think it's very good for wrestling generally. It gives people leverage. I mean, for the first time, if you are paying women equally, you've got people like Sasha Banks and Becky Lynch and Bayley and Charlotte Flair who suddenly have leverage with WWE. They can go somewhere else where they'll actually earn decent money. They're not going down for a pay cut in Impact Wrestling or going to Japan to earn similar money, but you know, all that travel and hard matches and so on. So it gives people options in North America, which is really cool. I think it's probably going to devastate companies like Impact in, for a start, who've just kind of got a balanced roster where they want it to be. The latest story this week here, the rumor is this week that they want the Lucha Brothers and are willing to pay a lot more money than Impact are. So that's kind of things that's going to cause problems. But equally, any new place to work creates holes in rosters elsewhere, and I don't think that's anything to be worried about as long as you don't lose too much talent in one go. I think Ring of Honor is probably going to cause the biggest issues there because they've lost 8 guys in like one fell swoop. I'd be worried about that, but overall I think it's going to be good for the industry. I don't have too many worries except for that pay issue and sustainability. It's not the first year, as Lucha Underground proved. The first year is fairly easy. It's the second, third, and fourth years. If they're going to be around a while, they're going to have to try really hard, and they're going to have to be willing to lose a lot of money to make this work. And they'll be looking to get it in the black as soon as they possibly can. But yeah, those are my major concerns. I want a decent women's division in AEW. I want it to be a balanced and decent women's division. Alistair Patton. Patton Drugs on Twitter says, what do you think is the most important factor in making an entrance more memorable or stand out more than others? Well, first of all is music, I think. I think you need some music that's going to stand out for you and also is going to be a certain dynamic. For instance, like Randy Orton's music, I think is dreadful. partly because I don't like Randy Orton's wrestler, and every time I hear it, I go, oh, God. So, yeah, I think there is music that can be bad for wrestlers' entrances. I think that it has to have that recognition factor straight away. For instance, a lot of the Japanese kind of theme tunes, when you hear them, have this slow build because they're used to people taking a long time getting to the ring. So, like, you only really recognize 2 or 3 of them. You recognize Tanahashi Go Ace, you recognize Kazuchika Okada, and you probably recognize Kenny Omega's as well. But most of them have a slow start, and it's not like this click. Like, to me, the perfect entrance music is Bret Hart's theme, Steve Austin's theme, and The Rock's theme, because they have all this bang start, like the Bret Hart theme. Dun, 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 dun. So it's just like a little bit, a tiny bit of slow, grab your attention, then into the main idea. And same thing with Steve Austin, Break the Glass, It's Your Ass. That's a brilliant way of getting things started in the piece of music. And you compare that with a lot of modern pieces of music, they don't work anywhere near as well. I think the best one personally for me is Becky Lynch, partly because it's kind of like based on a Dropkick Murphys kind of sound, and I'm a big Dropkick Murphys fan. So, you know, to appeal to me, Becky Lynch's theme tune is perfect, but it doesn't appeal to everybody. As far as the entrance is concerned, I think a lot of the time people mix up performance with intensity. I mean, you watch Minoru Suzuki come into the ring, it couldn't be any simpler. The Minoru Suzuki walking to the ring, black towel over his head, pair of black tights, black boots. Doesn't change anything for big shows. Might wear white. Occasionally he wears white, but generally speaking, he wears black. He walks down to the ring looking broody and mean, barely looks up from underneath his towel, but it matches that piece of music. It matches that no-nonsense style of his, and he just terrifies people. So he doesn't need to have the big theatrics to make it all work. Steve Williams and Doc Gordy, when they were in All Japan, had a very similar thing. They would just stare down the camera on the way to the ring, run the ropes, have this big introduction, and it looked and sounded amazing, but they weren't doing anything with big fireworks or big introductions. It was just them being intense. And I think that's something that, you know, a lot of the time in WWE, people miss out on is the intensity of an entrance. You know, like Finn Balor has a fairly intense entrance when he's Demon Balor. And that's the kind of like where, you know, he started that in New Japan when he was doing the big shows there. So, you know, but he was still an intense individual, and that's what made it work for him. And when he transfers it to WWE, it's still a big, big stage. That's kind of really why I think it's intensity. Fired up and ready to go. Either babyface fire or badassery as a heel are really the big things that make things stand out for me. Music, intensity. I mean, your actions as well. I mean, you can go down tagging fans if you want to. It's a bit passé now, isn't it? You know, whereas back in the day, it was very much like you go watch, even like today in New Japan, Kenny Omega and Kota Ibushi still tag hands. But it was considered a bit passé, really, for a long time. So, yeah, I think it's worthwhile. Still, if to be a true babyface, people like Bayley should do things like that. But if you're a heel, then you need to be ignorant of the fans as much as you possibly can. So there's kind of my outlay on what makes a strong entrance, really. HB, Isadore's Dragon, sends the question. Imagining a scenario in which Vince is no longer in charge and Triple H not only takes over, brings several other wrestlers, former wrestlers on board to help run shows. Which three wrestlers do you think bring the best ideas and advice to the table? I'm presuming this is running WWE. I like the idea of Triple H just turns up to an old Japan card and went, I'm in charge now. Really good question. I don't watch the WWE product enough to give you a strong idea of how that would work. But let's say if I was looking for three guys to run a company off the top of my head in North America who knew their stuff inside out, for a start, I'd want Heyman on creative. That's the first thing. I wouldn't even like bring in a new guy. I would want Heyman on creative. I want him bringing ideas in, trying to develop the talents that you've got, doing all the things he does really well, hiding problems, bringing things to the fore. So it's not even a wrestler. I would get Heyman for a start. I'd want Dr. Tom Pritchard to produce stuff because he's the best trainer of wrestlers I know of in North America. He had a hand in all sorts of big names like John Cena, Dave Bautista. He was a solid coach who just started his own wrestling school. He's been talking about that on the Steve Austin podcast, and Jim Ross talked about it on his podcast this week. Big hand in what Colt Cabana did. He's likable. He works hard. He knows how to make people understand the business, and he's very intense that way. So I would think, personally, I'd want Heyman as the creative guy, trying to control creative. You've got all those writers you can't get rid of, but I'd want him in charge of everything. I want Tom Pritchard running the producers alongside Dave Finley, who's already there, to look after the women's division because no one's done a better job with women in North America than him, with the exception of Sarah Del Rey. But she'd probably want to keep her in NXT so she could look after that farm feeder system that they've got that she's doing quite well. So, yeah, Dave Finley, because Dave Finley is an outstanding human being, an outstanding wrestler, and was an outstanding producer for the WWE for a long time. So as far as old guys I'd bring in, they're kind of already there. I mean, Dr. Tom's the only one I would bring in again, just because he had an understanding of how to get the best out of people. And I think that's really where you've got three people there who are experts at bringing the best out of people, showing and highlighting their positives and getting rid of their negatives, which is kind of like the Triple H way of thinking. And Heyman kind of, he didn't invent it, but he's the guy who perfected it in ECW. You could get the most out of the roster that you've got with those three guys. And yeah, that would be who I'd bring out of retirement to bring together. It's not a particularly fanciful list. It's not like, you know, The Rock, because he's great at promos or anything like that. It's just guys who I think would be a practical fit, who know their place in the industry, who wouldn't try too hard. Because a lot of the things, I've just been writing an article for Steel Chair magazine and talking about New Japan Pro Wrestling. It should be out this week. And a lot of the things that's successful in New Japan is the fact they don't panic. They're not after the mainstream pop all the time. They are, but they'd rather make their own mainstream pop than follow somebody else's. And with WWE, there tends to be this panic about the place. Oh my God, the ratings have gone through the floor. We'd best do something quick. And it's kind of like what Impact used to do as well. And they've stopped doing it too. Instead, Impact have a plan from TV taping to TV taping and they execute it. If you don't like it, don't worry. There'll be something you do like. Like, I don't tend to like their programming much at the moment, but there's bits in it I do like. And WWE just don't do that. They just panic. And oh my God, we've got to have a cat running Monday Night Raw, because otherwise we won't have any ratings. And it's like, yeah, all right then, if you must. So, yeah, I think that's it. I think I'd bring in these three as steady hands. and make sure you've got a short leash on Heyman so he can't go too far. And I'd give Dave Finlay the run of the women's division. Like, tell Heyman outlines where it has to go. Dave executes it. Same for the men, but with Dr. Tom Pritchard. And that's what I do. Not particularly exciting. Just that's what I do. Okay. Next question. Interesting question from New Wrestling Account. That is, it's Leave It Be 22 on New Wrestling Account Online. She asks, what could be done to make weight divisions in pro wrestling work better? Sorry. They ask, what could be done to make weight divisions in pro wrestling work better than they do currently? Interesting question. So I'm guessing we're looking at 205 Live more than anything. It took a while for that to develop. And I think it's, you know, worthwhile programming. It's got a lot of fans. You know, our good friend Pasta Sauce on Twitter there, she follows 205 Live like you wouldn't believe. It's her thing. It's exactly what she wants to see in a wrestling program. Okay, so how can we put this? What makes that work and not work the way it did before? I think really, like, if you look at the junior heavyweight division in Japan, it's very different to anything else that goes on in the company. The guys are smaller, yes, physically smaller, but they wrestle in a different style as well. There's an identity to the IWGP Junior Heavyweight Championship that's been there since the mid-1980s, really, when Tiger Mask and Dynamite Kid were feuding over the WF Junior Heavyweight title, which is what the IWGP title is now, more or less. And not two different belts and two different lineages. Don't, like, you know, get angry at me over that. I know they're completely different, but essentially it's the same job for those two belts. Because they've had this different identity to the main roster, they've been able to develop themselves. It gave somewhere for younger guys to want to go work. You get the influence of people like Ultimo Dragon was highly influenced by Tiger Mask and Dynamite. And it kind of like spawned an entire style. You know, Dragon Gate kind of is based on that style. But why don't weight divisions work? I think a lot of it is just normalizing stuff. Like, the best place for weight divisions was Europe in the 1960s and 70s, specifically Britain and Mexico, because they have lots of wrestlers who are different sizes and they don't treat them any differently to the heavyweights. You know, Rey Mysterio Jr. was a welterweight champion in AAA. He wasn't even a heavyweight. He was nowhere near a heavyweight. He had to wrestle heavyweights all the time in trios matches and Atomico's matches, but he was put in a weight division. Him and Juventud Guerrera really kind of made their name in that welterweight division, especially with guys like Heavy Metal. There was lots of cool wrestling in that time period, and just because they were lighter didn't mean they were worse. They were quite happy to showcase these smaller talents in the same way they showcased the heavier talents. So that's part of it. You've got to have no separation between the two, okay? Especially like the European style and like in the British style, lightweights often headline cards. I did middleweights. In fact, heavyweights were considered a bit boring, to be honest with you. Once Billy Robinson left, there was Wayne Bridges and quite a few heavyweights were interesting, but it was the super heavyweights who were really the drawing card, the big daddies and the giant haystacks, and the kind of regular heavyweights were just a bit, yeah, all right then. The British heavyweight champion Ray Steele was a great wrestler and a big draw, but he wasn't as fascinating as Marty Jones, the light heavyweight champion, or Mark Rocco, the middleweight champion, who were much more dynamic wrestlers who had much more of a dynamic draw. So I think you just have to do that. You have to have people who are dynamic, entertaining wrestlers, and you have to let them be. You have to let them do the things they need to do. I mean, you look at Mustafa Ali in 205 Live, who's moved up to the main roster now, who's doing incredible things because he's been allowed to be who he is and do what he wants to do. It's the same wrestling, as same as any other wrestling. You know, it's let the guys be believable characters people can connect to and try and give them the same respect. You know, it'd be actually quite wonderful for 205 Live to headline Monday Night Raw every once in a while. You know, build up a big angle, make it interesting and develop it that way. That's the reason why the junior heavyweights in Japan have worked so hard. You have a junior heavyweight tournament in every company except for Dragon Gate, where they're all junior heavyweights. They have tournaments there all the time. So there is a round robin tournament and a single elimination tournament in All Japan, in Noah, in New Japan. So those divisions have a healthy, talented roster and highly respected. And those are the guys that have changed the business. You look back in the last 20 years, there's not just Tiger Mask, there's also Grey Sasuke, there's also Super Delphin, there's also Grand Niniwa from Michinoku Pro. You could talk about Liger, you can talk about a bunch of guys who changed the way we think about professional wrestling. And that isn't necessarily true with smaller weight divisions around the world. You haven't yet had in WWE 205 Live a guy that will change the industry. You maybe did have him Pac, but he wasn't really there long enough to make it stick. Okay, so you kind of like those lower divisions, they kind of like need era defining wrestlers, just like the bigger divisions do. I mean, you look at Europe, you had guys like Johnny Saint, world lightweight champion for 10 times and for God knows how long, but you know, it helped establish that division as a guy that was entertaining, that was respected, that was a sporting draw. George Kidd before him helped with that tremendously. So you need a genre-defining wrestler and a genre-defining character to really get over the fact that weight divisions are different. Oh yeah, we'll finish on one story which was set by... Hang on a minute. Okay then, we've got two more questions to ask. Two more questions have been asked. One is from Christy from Wrestling Sexism, who asked me in DMs. Three questions. I'm going to answer one of the three so we can save them for another time. My one of the three questions is, which junior would you most like to see in the G1 one day? Whether it's realistic or not does not matter. If I had one junior to go into the G1 Climax tournament, I would say I would really like to see Desperado, actually, because I think his submission style in the G1 and his mix of lucha and submissions and all the things he does would be really interesting in the G1. I don't think anyone else kind of like necessarily flips the heavyweight switches for me that they'd be able to match up and have interesting matches with everybody, but I think Despy would do the job. I think he'd be really an interesting pick for the G1 myself. So I would go with Desperado. The next question is from Tony from Freelance Wrestling Rewind. He asks, on a personal level, what was the first memory you have of wrestling in all its different incarnations, British, American, and Japanese? So I think this is a nice one to end on. Okay then, so when did I first come across British wrestling? That was easy. World of Sport television in the late 1970s. My dad was a fan, my mum was a fan, so I watched it there to start with. My very first wrestling card was at Winterton Summer Fate. insert your own joke there, international listeners. A Summer Fate is the... an event in the summer. Usually most towns have them. They have some big summer festival. Okay, and there was wrestling in the village park. Okay, or the town park. Winterton's really a town. Actually, I'm good friends with the current mayor of Winterton, and I've hung out in Winterton a lot since then. And we were me, Sai, and Carl Gack, who's a wrestling photographer and journalist who does photography for the North Wrestling Promotion now. We were trying to organise wrestling at Winterton Fate, and the mayor was on our side, but we never quite got it organised at the behest of Robbie Brookside, who encouraged us on Twitter last year. He got us into mischief as we were talking with him about the fact that he'd wrestled in Winterton for years and years and years at Winterton Fate. So that was the first live wrestling experience I had in Britain. And then after that, I was kind of hooked. Biggest match I saw when I was young was Dave Finley versus Marty Jones. Marty Jones being my hero, the wrestler I kind of looked up to the most as a kid. My first experience of American wrestling actually came via World of Sport as well. Towards 1986 to 1988, the TV contract changed, and it was split in thirds. So one week it would be All-Star Wrestling, one week it'd be Joint Promotions, and then the other week it would be the WWF. And it'd be highlights of stuff from Madison Square Garden. So the very first North American match I saw was Bret Hart and Jim Neidhart, who, funnily enough, I already knew, because Bret Hart had wrestled on World of Sport in the early 80s, versus the Dynamite Kid and David Boy Smith, the British Bulldogs. And it was one of those classic Hart Foundation versus British Bulldogs wrestling matches from Madison Square Garden, which I thoroughly enjoyed. I probably should be able to find on YouTube somewhere, I would think, because a lot of those MSG matches are up there. So I will have a look and see if I can find it. But yeah, that was the origin story for me in British wrestling. My first experience of Japanese wrestling... My first experience of Japanese wrestler was Samuel Lee in the late 1970s on World of Sport television. And then Quick Kick Lee, who came along in the early 1980s. That was, of course, Satoru Sayama, who'd be Tiger Mask, and Akira Maeda, who would be, you know, friggin' Akira Maeda. That was the first time I saw Japanese wrestlers. The first time I saw Japanese wrestling, Flying Fuji Yamada, who was just in Thunder Liger, I saw him in 86 as well, had a similar protean run. The first Japanese show I saw from beginning to end would have been from the late, early 1990s, Eurosport used to do a program called Ring Warriors. They had the rights to the New Japan product, and it was commentated on by, first of all, Craig DeGeorge, terrible WWE commentator from the mid-1980s, who was partnering with, Sir Oliver Humperdinck. And then as the show progressed, thankfully, they got Gordon Solie to do it, which was a breath of fresh air. So it was the key era, early 90s New Japan Pro Wrestling, Tokyo Dome four times a year, and they'd do a highlight package with an overdubbed soundtrack, which was quite fun to listen to, especially when it was Solly and Oliver Humperdinck. And that was excellent. I love that show. And it had some big matches. Tony Holm versus Big Van Vader I saw on there. Jushin Liger versus the Ultimo Dragon. There you go. The other day, actually went round to my dad's like a couple months ago, and he'd found an old tape of it, a VHS tape, and he'd been watching it. And it was Ultimo Dragon versus Jushin Thunder Liger from the Tokyo Dome. Hase and Sasaki versus the Steiners, the key era of New Japan Wrestling that I really got into to start with. Hashimoto. The first time I saw Hashimoto, he was tagging with Masahiro Chono, and it was unreal to see this little, as my dad described him, a barrel of lard on two legs. And we thought, well, not much to him. And then watch him just unload on his opponents. And that was the first real proper strong style wrestler I ever saw. He was unreal the first time I saw him. That's what got hooked me or hooked on Japanese wrestling. The first time I saw Joshi would have been through the Gaia Girls documentary. And, well, maybe not that. Tate traded some stuff for some Joshi. I think the very earliest Joshi I ever saw was there was a couple of All Japan women who went to do a show for Stu Hart, which we had a tape of. We had a Stampede show tape that had managed to work its way through me from a tape trading list. And there was an AJW match from that. And that was in the mid-1990s. That was the first time I'd seen Joshi properly. And I started really getting into it after that. Gaia Girls would be the first kind of like in-depth thing I ever saw into it in the early 2000s. And then after that, Wrestling Channel came along and it became a lot easier to watch everything. And then YouTube kind of took over from that, so you can find any wrestling match you want nowadays, can't you? So that was kind of like my origin stories. And that's kind of been the Troopany show for this week. My name's James Troopany. That was my show. I would like to thank you for listening, because I don't get a chance to do this often enough. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate the nice comments we get, the 5-star reviews we get on iTunes, all the cool things you say about us. Thank you very much, and thank you for listening to us. We will move into the new year with new wrestling to talk about. I'd also like to thank my regular contributors, Chelsea Spalding at shouldersup.net. You can find her at Shoulders Up on Twitter. You can find Christy at SmarkInfested on Twitter, as well as at New Japan Gifts and at Wrestling Sexism. You can find Marcus Green at Paradox Kid, Alex Edwards at Alex_Edwards_AlexWatt at AlexWatt187, and Simon Heath at Butlin's Club. Take care. Enjoy Mike Freeland's Wrestling Rewind. Please find us on Facebook, The Troopany Show. Find us on Twitter, at Troopany Show. And find us on Patreon, where you can keep The Troopany Show free forever for everyone at The Troopany Show. Take care, and we'll see you soon. Bye!